Don't think any of my crew is either. Maybe a girlfriend or two. Relationships are difficult when you live and work on a cargo jump ship. We'll return any of your crew who don't want to join us, Nathan explained. But we are taking your cargo and your ship, I'm afraid. No worries, Captain, Captain Taff assured Nathan. I can't speak for my entire crew, of course, but I don't expect any of them are eager to return to Coronair. Not as long as the Dusan are in control. Thank you, Captain Taff, Nathan replied. If you can spare some time, I'm sure my chief of intelligence would love to pick your brain. Happy to help, sir, Captain Taff replied eagerly. Corporal Eliason, would you please escort Captain Taff to Lieutenant Commander Shinoda in the intelligence shack?
Aye, sir,
Corporal Eliason replied. Captain Taff, if you'll follow me. Captain? Captain Taff said respectfully as he followed the Gadajak corporal across the hangar deck. Nathan turned to watch the young captain walk away as Marcus came up to stand beside him.
What do you think of him? Nathan wondered.
Never saw him as a leader, that's for sure, Marcus said. But he never gave me much trouble, always did his job and never complained much. Sure as hell seems happy to see you again, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, he does, Nathan replied. I have to admit, it kind of caught me off guard.
Nathan sighed and turned back toward the Saiki. You can stand the ship down, he told Marcus. The Saiki is not going on any more missions until Vlad's people finish installing plasma torpedo cannons on her.
You sure that's necessary, Captain? Marcus wondered. Seems like the more weapons you install on her, the more dangerous her missions become.
War is hell, Nathan joked, turning to walk away. Burke and Cuddy lay in the small, dark cave, still panting. Burke's body ached from the beating it had taken during their escape, and he was certain he had at least a few broken ribs, if not other broken bones in his body. He glanced at Cuddy. Other than dirt, sweat, and a few lacerations that had stopped bleeding hours ago, he appeared to be intact.
"I think we're safe for now," Michael proclaimed as he stepped back into the cave.
"Shouldn't we keep moving?" Cuddy wondered, concern in his tone.
"Easy for you to say," Burke moaned.
"The ore in these mountains should prevent detection by Dusan sensors," Michael explained as he placed his small portable light on the cave floor.
"And the entrance to this cave was small enough that I was able to close it off with a few boulders and some Icon moss. Unless one is specifically looking for it, the entrance should go unnoticed."
"And if they find it?" Cuddy said. "There is no other way out, you know."
"If they find it, we die," Michael admitted. "But we will die fighting," he added, holding up his energy rifle.
"What about air?" Burke wondered. "If you sealed up the entrance..."
"There is still a slight breeze coming through, so there must be some other openings to the surface."
"Maybe there is another way out, then," Burke suggested hopefully.
"It is possible," Michael agreed. "However, it is just as likely that they are impassable."
"I still think we should keep moving," Cuddy insisted. "We could find our way to the nearest town and get some help."
"From whom?" Michael asked.
"Surely there are people who want the Dusan gone as much as we do," Cuddy said.
"Most people are just trying to keep out of the Dusan's way at this point," Michael told them. "They'd be just as likely to turn us in as they would to help us. That was the whole point of the Dusan's aggressive initial assault, total dominance. The psychological effect on the population is greater than you think. Caius was well aware of this. That is why he had the Gadajak program to be loyal to him, so he could use them as shock troops to scare the hell out of people."
Michael settled down next to Burke.
"We stay put for now. We rest and we collect our thoughts. Then we decide what to do next."
"We don't have any food or water," Cuddy pointed out.
"We can survive for weeks without food," Michael replied. "As for water, 3, maybe 4 days. There is a river not far from here. In a day or two, it should be safe for me to go out at night to retrieve some water."
"What if the Dusan are actively scanning the area with satellites?" Cuddy asked. "If we keep moving now, we can get further away before they have the chance to retask a satellite to this area, right?"
"Does he look like he can keep moving for much longer?" Michael asked, pointing at Burke.
"I'm good,"
Burke protested between pants.
"No, you are not," Michael insisted.
Burke looked at Cuddy.
"Sorry, he's right. I'm not."
Cuddy leaned back against the rocky wall of the small cave and sighed.
"Do you think it was our comm system?"
"No way,"
Burke insisted.
"Do not do this to yourself," Michael warned. "It serves no purpose. Besides, there are 100 ways the Dusan could have learned of our location."
"They tested the system, Cuddy," Burke reminded him.
"Quite thoroughly, in fact," Michael added. I still believe the system to be safe, but once the other cells realize we have been compromised, they will stop using it, at least for now.
Then we're on our own, Cuddy realized.
For the foreseeable future, yes. Michael picked up his light from the cave floor and leaned against the wall. I suggest that everyone try to get some rest.
Michael turned off the light, leaving them in complete darkness.
Can we keep the light on? Burke asked. I think it's best to conserve its energy, Michael insisted.
Isn't it solar-powered?
Yes, but we do not know when we will be able to safely recharge it.
What's the matter, Burke? Are you afraid of the dark?
Cuddy teased, trying to lighten the mood.
Today? Yes. Yes, I am.
Kayla Yosef sat on one of the many balconies of the second-floor cafe. At least twice per week, she treated herself to a meal here, where she could watch the boats as they meandered down the Seine. Her recent transfer to Paris had been a dream come true. The research facility here was arguably the best on Earth, if not the best in all the Sol Alliance. Over the last 5 years, every breakthrough in sensor technology had come from the famed Duquan Institute. Fortunately, her experience aboard the Aurora and her involvement in the development of the sensor suites currently being used by the Cape Town had given her an edge over other applicants. For the first time since she had enlisted, she finally felt as if she were in the right place. If everything worked out, she might even put down some roots, something she had not been able to do over the last 10 years. Kayla picked up her glass of wine and took a sip. As she placed her glass back on the table, the sounds of the city suddenly went quiet.
"Mind if I join you, Commander?" a man asked from behind.
Kayla turned to look, her mouth falling agape when she spotted him.
"Oh, my God!"
she exclaimed, rising from her seat to embrace her friend. "What are you doing here?"
"Looking for you," Captain Hun said as he took a seat.
"How on earth did you find me?"
"It wasn't easy, believe me," he admitted. "Luckily, you're a creature of habit. I tailed you a few times after work. Once I realized that you ate here on a regular basis, I just waited until you showed up again."
"I don't understand. Why didn't you just call?"
"Comms can be tapped," Captain Hunt replied. The reason the street sounds had disappeared suddenly became apparent to her.
"Are you running a sound suppression field? We can detect them, you know."
"Everybody's got them these days," Chris insisted. "We'd just be two people who want some privacy, just like millions of others all over the world."
"What's going on, Chris?"
"I'm putting together a crew, one made up of people who once served under Captain Scott. I was hoping you'd be interested, but..."
"But what?"
"Well, now that I see you've landed your dream job, forget it. Forget I said anything. Let's just have a nice meal and catch up."
"Right,"
she retorted. "Like I'm going to drop it that easily. Spit it out, Chris. What are you up to, and why all the cloak-and-dagger stuff?"
Chris eyed her for a moment, part suspicion, part trust. "You're one of the few of us left in the service. Why didn't Gagliardi push you out like he did the rest of us?"
"I've thought about that myself at times," Kayla admitted. "The best explanation I could come up with was that I was transferred off the Aurora long before those final days. In the end, I was in R&D. Of course, I'd also like to think that I'm just so good that he couldn't afford to get rid of me, but..."
"Do you hear from any of them?" Chris wondered.
"The gang from the Aurora?
Not really.
So many of them were from the PC, after all. I did run into Cassandra Evans when I first moved back here. She works in administration at the Institute. Something to do with psych profiling, I think."
"Anyone else?"
"Not really."
She looked at him long and hard.
"Spit it out, Chris. What's going on?"
Chris studied her, trying to determine if he could trust her. She had been one of Captain Scott's most trusted officers during her time on the Aurora, and had been with him for their entire adventure through the Pantorus Cluster, from the initial super jump all the way through to the liberation of Earth from the Jung. If anyone would still feel a sense of loyalty to Nathan Scott, it would be Kayla Yosef.
"What I'm about to tell you is a secret," he began. "And when I tell you, you're going to be shocked, so try not to react."
"You think someone is watching us?"
"Not really," Chris admitted. "But it's better to assume they are."
"Okay,"
she said, mentally preparing herself.
"I'm ready."
Chris paused a moment, not so much for dramatic effect, but because he truly enjoyed this moment. She would be the 15th person to whom he would reveal the truth, and all 14 before her were in complete disbelief at first.
"Well?" Kayla urged, growing impatient.
"Nathan Scott is alive.
He's back in command of the Aurora and is leading a rebellion against the Dusan and the PC. Chris waited for the usual reaction, for the look of shock and confusion, but it never came. Instead, he could see the wheels turning inside her head. "You're either not surprised or you've got incredible self-control," he finally commented. "Actually, I already knew. In fact, I've known for 7 years now." "What?" Now it was Chris who was shocked. Then it dawned on him. "Hayes. We had a big fight when he told me he was going back to the Pentaurus sector."
"I thought you two were already split up by then."
"Only because I got reassigned," she told him. "When he said he was leaving, it really upset me. I was so hurt. He couldn't stand to see me that way, so he told me the real reason he was leaving."
"Then he was in on it all along."
"Him, Loki, Eliza, Marcus, all of them. I'm pretty sure I was the only one on Earth who knew. They didn't even tell his family. When did you find out?"
"About 2 weeks ago," Chris replied. "His sister Miri sent me a message asking for help. Apparently, they only found out about a month ago when Nathan sent word back asking her to get a message to Cameron."
"Then that's where the Aurora went," Kayla realized. "No one's heard from her for several weeks, as best I can tell. We just assumed she went dark, chasing a sensor contact or something. Wow, I can't believe Gagliardi actually sent the Aurora to the PC. Wait, who are the Dusan?"
"Some rogue faction of the Jung, as I understand it," Chris explained. "And Gagliardi didn't send the Aurora to the PC. Captain Taylor took it upon herself to go."
"Cameron Taylor stole her own ship?"
"Yup."
"Cameron Taylor. By the book, Cameron Taylor?"
"The very same."
Now Kayla was surprised. "What the hell is going on, Chris?"
"A lot, believe me," Chris assured her. "So, are you in?"
"What do you think?" she replied with a smile.
Just like that, her dream job vanished from her mind, and soon from her life. The small, uninhabited Molo farm sat baking in the long day sun on Haven. Once the home of a poor family, the dusty complex built into the bottom of a wide sinkhole had been quiet the last 28 Haven years. Other than a ship that had camped out for a few days some time ago, the farm was abandoned, and for all intents and purposes, it looked it. An unmarked Ronnie jump shuttle suddenly appeared as if from nowhere, skimming low across the surface toward the abandoned Molo farm, dust swirling behind it. Seconds later, the thunderous clap of its sudden displacement of the dusty moon's atmosphere preceded the shuttle's arrival at the Molo farm. The shuttle slowed as it reached the depression, lowering further as it crossed the ridge, finally touching down in the center of the abandoned complex, only a few meters from the stone bunkhouse, behind the dilapidated, half-destroyed main house. As soon as the shuttle's gear touched the dusty surface, its hatch opened, and four armed men stepped out in practiced fashion. Two of them took up defensive positions while the pilot inside kept the engines running for a quick departure. The other two men moved briskly into the stone bunkhouse. A minute later, the two men came back outside, and all four men returned to the shuttle. As the last man boarded, the shuttle's engines began to spin up. The shuttle rose slowly off the surface, creating a swirl of dust as it climbed. Once its hatch was closed, the shuttle disappeared, creating a swooshing sound as the air around it moved in to replace the void left behind by the shuttle's sudden departure from Haven's atmosphere. Once again, the small, uninhabited Molo farm was silent, as it would remain until it was visited again. Nathan crouched down to one side of the hatch, his energy pistol in hand, watching as Jessica signaled him from the opposite side of the hatch. After nodding his understanding of her instructions, she bolted through the hatch, firing as she moved from right to left into the next room. Nathan immediately followed, moving left to right, a step behind her. Enemy fire immediately greeted them, slamming into the walls, deck, and overheads all around them as they both charged for the far sides of the next compartment. Splitting up had served its intended purpose, and it divided their opponent's aim. The firing pattern was erratic. A few shots at Jessica, then a few at Nathan as he moved the opposite direction. But when the shots were aimed at Nathan, they were not aimed at Jessica. That led Nathan to believe they were facing only one man. Nathan dove for cover behind a large counter on the far right of the compartment, rolling on the deck as he landed, shots slamming into the counter as he arrived. Jessica opened up again, drawing the enemy's fire. Nathan rose from his cover to take the shooter out, knowing that he would have to step into his firing line to get a clean shot at Jessica. Unfortunately, it was a mistake. As soon as Nathan stood, three shots landed on his chest, knocking him backward and triggering the alarm on his chest plate.
A horn blared, signaling the training exercise was over. "What the hell were you thinking?" Jessica barked as she walked out from behind her cover, holstering her weapon.
"I thought it would take him out when he stepped out to fire on you," Nathan replied as he turned off the alarm on his chest piece.
"Did it ever occur to you that there were two of them?"
Jessica questioned. "He fired at you and then me," Nathan defended, "so I figured there was only the single shooter."
"You fell for an obvious ploy," Jessica chastised, "and an old one at that."
"Sorry," Nathan apologized as he got back on his feet. "I thought I was being clever."
"If you were being clever, you wouldn't have assumed a single shooter. If you were being clever, you would have waited for instructions from me. If you were being clever, you would have remembered that you were facing experienced Gata Jacques, who specialize in subterfuge."
"If I were being clever, I would have stayed in my ready room instead of agreeing to come down here to be humiliated by you," Nathan interjected.
"Hey, you're the one who decided you wanted to be down in the trenches with the troops this time around, and there's no way I'm letting you cover my ass until you've had proper training."
"I believe I've already covered your ass on more than one occasion," he reminded her as he removed his chest piece and touched his chest. He winced in pain. "These damn training weapons really pack a wallop, don't they?"
"Provides motivation to not be stupid,"
Jessica mumbled as General Tellis entered the training area. "Go ahead, tell me how much I suck," Nathan invited. "I believe the lieutenant commander has already covered that quite well," the general stated. "To be honest, I am surprised that you fell for the lone shooter fake. You are usually more intuitive under fire." "I guess I'm a little off my game today," Nathan admitted. "A lot going on up here, what with all the negotiations and such. The Gata Jacques are able to block out distractions of the mind when necessary."
"And how do you do that?"
"By first recognizing what those distractions are."
"Simple as that, huh?"
Nathan looked at Jessica.
"Don't look at me," she said, putting her hands up. "I haven't mastered that one yet, at least not entirely."
"It takes years of practice," the general said. "Shall we try again?"
Nathan groaned.
"Captain, intel," Lieutenant Commander Shinoda called over Nathan's comm set. Nathan tapped his comm set.
"Go ahead.
We have a message from Tarek Espin on Takara."
"We'll be there shortly,"
Nathan replied. "Thank God," he added after closing the connection.
"I can't believe the kid actually had the guts to send a message," Jessica said, as she, Nathan, and General Tellis entered the Aurora's intelligence office.
"Wait till you see it," Lieutenant Commander Shinoda warned as he handed Nathan a data pad. Nathan looked at the data pad, immediately becoming silent.
"What does the kid have to report?"
Jessica wondered, noticing the look of surprise on Nathan's face. "Navarro's alive," Nathan replied, "and he's on Takara using the name Tenzin Dalit." Nathan handed Jessica the data pad. "He's planning on stealing the Tayenta."
"Is that even possible?"
Jessica wondered, reading the message for herself before handing it to General Tellis.
"Somebody want to tell me what the Tayenta is?" Lieutenant Commander Shinoda asked.
"It is a Takaran battleship that was commissioned by House Ta'akar before Prince Casimir's assassination," General Tellis explained.
"That's the big sucker in their shipyards, right?"
"Precisely," the general replied.
"The Dusan have been trying to finish that thing ever since they got here," Jessica stated.
"According to Mr. Espen, they are only a few months away from completion. Her department heads are already aboard, and her crew will begin reporting in a few weeks," Lieutenant Commander Shinoda stated.
"How the hell does Navarro expect to steal a battleship right out from under the Dusan's nose all by himself?"
Jessica wondered. "By himself, it would be quite impossible," General Tellis insisted. "However, with our help, there might be a way."
Everyone looked at General Tellis.
"I did say might," the general reminded them.
"We need to establish communication with Navarro," Nathan said. "The sooner the better."
"The only way we have is through Espen,"
Jessica reminded him. "I'm not sure he's up for the task."
"We could send our own operatives," Nathan suggested.
"Perhaps one of your men, General."
"A possibility," the general agreed. "But that could take time."
"If Tarek approaches Navarro, Suvan is just as likely to kill him as believe him," Nathan surmised.
"That's what I would do," Jessica admitted.
"Captain Navarro may require proof that you are alive," General Tellis said.
"I have an idea," Nathan said. "Actually, I'm copying one of your ideas, General."
"A video?"
"It worked on Cameron."
"It'll need to be short, and it cannot contain too much information," Jessica warned. "We don't know for sure that it is Navarro."
"Good point," Nathan agreed. But it definitely should be from me. Nathan took in a deep breath, letting it out slowly. So what does one man who's supposed to be long dead say to another man who is also supposed to be dead? Nathan looked at all three of them. Only Lieutenant Commander Shinoda responded. What's new? Michael sat motionless in the bushes, his breath measured and shallow, watching the two Dusan soldiers not a meter away from him. He had nearly completed his late-night mission to retrieve water for the three of them, when two members of a Dusan search party had come to the same river as he. The two soldiers had been standing nearby for several minutes now, talking to one another in a language that Michael had yet to learn. Finally, after what seemed an eternity, one of the men left. But the other turned toward Michael, still not noticing him in the thick bushes, and opened his trousers to relieve himself. Michael stood perfectly still as the Dusan soldier drained his bladder into the very bush he stood behind. The soldier looked down as he completed his task. At that moment, Michael slowly began to pull his knife out of its sheath. If the soldier spotted him, he would sound the alarm, and Michael would be doomed. But if Michael took the soldier's life, his friends would realize that he was missing, which would bring more men to the area and doom all three of them. The other soldier came from afar, causing the Dusan before him to turn suddenly. The man shouted back, then closed his trousers and departed. Michael remained frozen for several minutes, his boots spattered with Dusan urine, wondering how he had been lucky enough to encounter the only two Dusan soldiers without bioscanners. Once he was certain the men had left the area, Michael moved slowly and quietly toward the cave where Burke and Cuddy waited. He now had water for them to drink, and a variety of edible nuts and berries to sustain them for a few days. And his boots would dry. Ito Yokama stepped up to the podium carefully, his body still recovering from the injuries he sustained 9 days ago. Nanites were swirling about inside of him, busily working to repair his body. He felt fortunate that he had not experienced any of the intense discomfort he had been warned was possible. Yet he could swear that at times he could feel the microscopic robots knitting tissue deep within his neck, despite Dr. Chen's assurances that such sensations were nothing more than his imagination. Until now, he had managed to avoid the media. The first week had been easy enough, since he had spent it in the Aurora's medical department. A late-night arrival back on Rakuin had helped as well. But the time had come. Thanks to Captain Scott, Ito Yokama was now a hero of Rakuin, and any political ambitions he might have were practically guaranteed to be successful. Unfortunately, it also meant he would be forever beholden to the young leader of the Karazari, as the truth would surely ruin him, not just politically, but financially as well. His companies were heavily leveraged and deeply in debt. Any interruption in his revenues would be catastrophic, to say the least. So he found himself at this podium in front of 50 reporters who would connect him with all the eyes on Rakuin. Captain Scott had handed him the presidency on a silver platter. All he had to do was take it and run with it. One thing was sure, he had underestimated the young captain. He would not do so again. "I would like to make a statement," he said after clearing his throat. He waited a moment for the crowd of journalists to quiet down before speaking. "First, I would like to thank Lieutenant Commander Jessica Nash for her quick thinking and her calm under pressure. Her action saved my life, and her apprehension of my assailant quite possibly saved Rakuin. I will be forever in her debt. Second, I would like to thank Captain Nathan Scott for his kind words on my behalf. However, his rendition of the events was far more flattering than I deserve. The truth is, I unknowingly allowed a Dusan spy to move freely among us, simply because his presence offered an opportunity for financial gain. For that, I am truly sorry. It is sometimes too easy in our day-to-day lives to forget what is truly important. I shall not make that mistake again." Ito pulled himself closer to the podium, straightening up a bit more before continuing. "I now call upon the people of Rakuin to stand in opposition to the Dusan and all they represent. We must all band together. Rakuins, Naramesians, Karuzari, humans. We must stand together against those who had imposed their will upon us through the use of force and intimidation. To that end, I call upon the leaders of Rakuin to sign the Karuzari Alliance Charter. Thank you." Upon completion, Ito immediately turned and departed as gingerly as he had come, ignoring the questions being shouted at him. His lies had been small, no more than a few words bent at most. But his intentions had been sincere.
He truly felt that an alliance with the Karazari was now the only way Rakuan might survive the conflict that was about to come their way. General Hessen was not pleased. The last few days had been particularly difficult. Their defeat in the Rogan system had not been well received by Lord Dusan, and their inability to backtrack the Aurora and learn the location of the Karazari fleet had not helped matters. And now he had more bad news to report. Although their hold on the Pentaurus cluster was quite firm, the first 7.5 weeks of occupation had been challenging. The Takaran worlds had been cooperative for the most part, but the Koronarans had proven more difficult, due mostly to the Koronari, despite the fact that they had disbanded years ago. Only recently had the Dusan's elite Zen Anor been able to determine the location of several Koronari resistance cells, and had begun apprehending their members. But the network was turning out to be far more extensive than originally estimated. After decades of occupation by the Ta'akar, the Koronarans were quite adept at underground resistance operations, and still had much of their network in place, even after 8 years of freedom from Takaran rule. General Hessen held a begrudging admiration for the Koronarans. They were a strong people, unwilling to trade their freedoms for safety. Unlike the Takarans, who were more concerned with appearances than anything else, the Koronarans were people of action. They were fiercely loyal and did not tolerate dishonesty or deceit. They would make excellent additions to the Dusan Empire if they could find a way to get them under control, which the general doubted was possible. General Hessen entered Lord Dusan's office, walking toward his leader's desk at the far end of the room. "You ask to see me, my lord?" Lord Dusan did not look up from his viewscreen. "Still no sign of the Karazari fleet, I take it?" "I'm afraid not, my lord," the general replied. "The Karazari are going to great lengths to keep their fleet's location a secret. They have developed sophisticated algorithms, varying their jump patterns to a great degree to evade our tracking drones. The few times we've been able to track them through all of their jumps, they inevitably disappeared in the radiation fields of more massive stars, thus hiding their departure course from our drones." Lord Dusan finally looked up from his viewscreen, obviously displeased. But he knew there was no way to guess their routes beyond the stars the Karazari used to mask their escape. Space was vast, and the Karazari fleet was likely far from any well-traveled jump routes, for obvious reasons. Unfortunately, that same vastness made it a fantastic place to hide. "I would recommend that we keep our eyes on the Rogan system," General Hessen said. "The Karazari will attempt to form an alliance with the Rakuans in order to bring their Gunyoki fighters into their fleet." "The Gunyoki are no match for our heavy fighters," Lord Dusan insisted. "As currently configured, they are not," General Hessen agreed. "But if equipped with jump drives, especially ones with series jump capabilities, they could pose a threat to our security." "Perhaps, but they have no chance against our warships." "If used in sufficient numbers, they could be quite effective," General Hessen warned. "And Rakuan has more than 500 Gunyoki fighters, my lord." "And you think they could equip them all with jump drives?" Lord Dusan challenged. "In short order?" "I think they will try," the general replied. "It will take time, of course. Once the Tayenta is operational, we should be able to shut them down, thus neutralizing the threat long before their numbers become a concern." "Then the Tayenta's completion is ahead of schedule?" Lord Dusan inquired. "She should be ready for limited operations in a few weeks." "Limited operations?" Lord Dusan wondered. "She is already able to navigate, and her jump drive should be operational by week's end. Once her shields and main gun batteries are complete, she will be more than capable of providing basic defenses for the Pentaurus cluster," General Hessen explained. "This will make it possible for us to send one of our battleships to dispatch Rakuan and Nair Mis if necessary." "I would prefer that both worlds are completely destroyed," Lord Dusan grumbled. "Better to make examples of them." "Nair Mis I would agree with destroying," the general agreed. "Her meager resources are not worth considering. Rakuan, on the other hand, has enough water to last us for centuries. Perhaps we should consider targeting her population centers with non-radiological weapons, destroy her populations, but leave the world habitable for our purposes." Lord Dusan cast a disproving gaze at the general's way. "I will consider it," he agreed, returning his attention to his viewscreen. "Increase the frequency of our reconnaissance missions to Rakuan," he instructed the general. "We must monitor the Rakuans closely." "As you wish, my lord."
The Tienta is a large ship, General Tellus stated. More than twice the size of the Aurora. She will require a large crew to achieve maximum effectiveness.
It will take time to put together a crew, Cameron added, let alone train them.
And to learn all her systems, Vladimir said. Gospody, that will take forever.
Nathan looked around the conference table in the Aurora's command briefing room. His senior officers had just started discussing the issue of the Tienta, and they were already painting a rather grim picture.
It would help if we could get some of the Tienta's designers to join us. That would be most difficult, General Tellus warned. Such men are very well paid and respected. Convincing them to risk everything, even to free their own world, will be difficult. Dakaran stand to protect what they have, even if it means putting up with a brutal dictator. The reign of Caius Ta'akar demonstrated this. In fact, it depended on it. The nobles are prime examples. They will do anything to protect their individual little empires, including turning a blind eye to atrocities committed against other humans. The fact that nearly half of Captain Navarro's crew remained on board when he denounced the new Takaran leadership was quite surprising.
"We're all talking about whether or not we could crew and operate the Tienta," Lieutenant Commander Shinoda said. "Is stealing her even possible?"
"Anything is possible," Nathan insisted. "In this case, I would not be so sure," General Tellus admitted.
Nathan looked at him, surprised.
"I am basing my opinion on limited information," General Tellus admitted. "It may change as we get more intelligence from Captain Navarro."
"Are we expecting more intel?" Cameron wondered. "We send a return message to Terra Gespen through our Haven comm relay," Jessica explained. "We asked him to make direct contact with Captain Navarro."
"Is that wise?" Cameron wondered. "How can we be sure it's really him? Even if it is, he could be compromised. The Dusan may have the same type of nanites that the Jung used to control Lieutenant Scalati."
"The nanites used by the Jung were obtained from a world called Estwazen, which was conquered long after the Dusan were exiled," Lieutenant Commander Shinoda told her.
"That doesn't mean the Dusan didn't get them someplace else," Cameron said. "The Koronarans have them, after all."
"The Koronaran nanites do not control their hosts," General Tellus pointed out. "However, your point is well taken."
"We can take appropriate steps to verify his identity," Jessica insisted. "However, determining whether or not Navarro has been compromised will be difficult."
She looked at General Tellus, then at Nathan.
"This could be an elaborate plan, meant to draw us into an ambush and on their terms."
She leaned back in her chair, sighing in frustration.
"When it comes down to it, we're going to be putting a lot of faith in Navarro, and we're going to be asking a lot of Terra Gespen. Just making contact with the Navarro alone is going to be risky. If Navarro gets spooked, who knows what he'll do to Terrig?"
"Suvan Navarro never struck me as the type to get spooked," Nathan insisted. "He will most likely realize that his chances of success rise dramatically if we coordinate our efforts," General Tellus pointed out. "I have a question," Vladimir said, raising his hand from the far end of the table. "How do we take control of this ship? Surely they have command codes just like we do."
"I have the codes," Deliza announced as she entered the room along with Abby. "Our apologies, Captain," Abby said. "The Tienta was designed and commissioned during my father's short tenure," Deliza explained as she and Abby took their seats at the conference table. "It was to be the first jump warship built by Takara from the ground up. It was to be a symbol of peace and cooperation between all the worlds of the Pantoris cluster that were formerly ruled by Caius. Actually, Tienta means togetherness in old Takaran."
"How does this help us?" Vladimir wondered.
"My father did not completely trust the houses who were contributing to the cost of the Tienta's construction," Deliza continued. "He had command override codes built into the Tienta's core command and control computers. It is hard-coded, deep in the root directories of her security cores."
"Surely the Dusan have removed the codes," Jessica insisted.
"Only four people knew of my father's embedded override codes," Deliza explained. "My father, myself, the technician who burned the codes into the courtships, and Yanni, of course."
"Yanni?" Jessica asked.
"It was his idea to burn them into the security courtships," Deliza explained. "That way no one could see them unless they were directly connected to those chips, which would require climbing into the core itself to make the connection."
"Are you saying we have to climb into the core of the Tienta's computer in order to take control of her?" Nathan wondered.
"Not at all," Deliza replied. "When a command code is entered, the security system starts by checking command codes at the lowest security level. If a match is not found, it goes up to the next level, and so on, until it finds a match. If none are found, access is not granted, and control is not given to the user. That search includes the hard-coded chips in the security core.
Even though a user cannot see them without being directly connected to the chips? Nathan said.
Precisely, Deliza replied.
Then it is possible, Vladimir said. To take control, yes, General Tellus agreed. But we still have to figure out how to get inside the Tayenta. That will not be easy. The Takaran shipyards are very well protected, and if the ship is nearing completion, some of her crew will already be aboard, including security personnel.
And the shipyards are deep in the heart of a Dusan-held system, Lieutenant Commander Shinoda added.
Any plan that we devise will be risky, to say the least, General Tellus warned. The question will not be if it can be done. The question will be, should we do it?
Is the risk worth the benefit? Jessica said.
Nathan sighed. We lost a lot of very good people just to secure 6 gunships. I can't imagine how many the Tayenta might cost us.
General Tellus looked around the briefing room. No one was saying what they were all thinking.
A battleship would give us a fighting chance. If nothing else, it would give us the ability to protect our fleet and the Rogan system while we engage the Dusan and the Pantorus cluster.
Which we could also do after arming Raku and Anaramis with a few thousand jump missiles, Jessica surmised.
And how long will that take? Nathan wondered. Months? Years? And how much more powerful will the Dusan become in that time?
A difficult decision, General Tellus said.
Nathan sighed again. We need more information, he decided.
We need Terragas Ben to put us in direct communication with Suvan Navarro so we can determine if, one, he is Suvan Navarro, and two, whether or not he has been compromised.
Are you sure you want to risk our only asset on Takara? Jessica wondered.
Want? No. But I don't see that we have a choice. We can't turn our back on a battleship.
Then you intend to steal the Tayenta? Cameron asked, shocked.
I intend on gathering more information, Nathan corrected. Nothing more.
He turned to Jessica. Get us in contact with Suvan Navarro, whatever it takes.
Aye, sir,
Jessica replied.
In 14 days, the Jung battle platforms in the Nor Susuian, Nor Kinney, and Nor Torosay systems will receive word of our initial retaliatory strikes on Jung military targets, Admiral Gagliardi explained to the representatives of the member worlds of the Sol Alliance. 5 days after that, the battle platform in the Nor Hensi system will be alerted, and 3 days after that, the one in the Nor Benati system. That's 5 Jung battle platforms, assuming that they are immediately ordered to head for Sol and using their known maximum FTL speed, we can postulate it will take 3 years for them to reach us. During those 3 years, the Trinidad, the Charleston, and the Philadelphia will be completed, along with 8 more destroyers and a few 100 more Cobra gunships.
Surely that will be enough to protect us, the representative from the Tau Ceti system insisted.
A single capital ship cannot defeat a Jung battle platform, Admiral Gagliardi warned. By our estimates, it takes a minimum of 2, perhaps even 3. So we would already be outnumbered, and that's just the battle platforms themselves. They never travel alone. They carry numerous frigates and gunships and are usually accompanied by at least 1, usually 2 battleships. The platforms in Nor Susuian and Nor Hensi each have 2 battleships and 1 heavy cruiser with them.
Admiral Gagliardi looked at the men and women in the room.
Quite frankly, we will not be able to repel such an attack. Even if by some miracle we do, it will be at great cost, a cost we may not be able to bear.
Perhaps we should not have launched that initial strike,
President Scott said from the opposite end of the table.
That strike was retaliatory in nature in response to Jung incursions into Alliance space, Admiral Gagliardi reminded them. Had we not done so, the Jung would already be on their way.
What I do not understand is why they intruded into our space to begin with, the representative from 82 Eridani wondered. Surely they know that we don't take such transgressions lightly.
I cannot answer that, Admiral Gagliardi admitted. I can only tell you how to best protect Alliance worlds. Destroying those battle platforms before they can reach marching orders is the best way to protect all of our worlds.
Doing so will guarantee an all-out war with the Jung, President Scott warned. There will not be 5 battle platforms and their associated escorts. There will be more than 100 warships headed our way.
Taking out their battle platforms will send a message that we mean business, Admiral Gagliardi insisted, that we are both willing and able to take the fight to them, rather than defending ourselves with our backs against the wall. If we take out their battle platforms, our capital ships will be free to attack their critical assets. I promise you we will bring the Zhong to their knees in a matter of months, with minimal alliance losses long before they can reach our worlds.
They already have, the minister from Alpha Centauri reminded them.
Those ships had to have been in transit for some time, Admiral Gagliardi insisted. For all we know, they were in alliance space since before the ceasefire.
That still does not explain why the Zhong, assuming they were Zhong ships, decided to show themselves, knowing full well that we would be forced to respond, President Scott challenged.
Again, I cannot explain the actions of the Zhong leadership, Admiral Gagliardi reiterated. Perhaps they want another war. Perhaps they were simply testing our resolve prior to launching an attack. Perhaps their leadership has gone off the deep end.
Admiral Gagliardi paused a moment, his gaze fixing on President Scott at the other end of the table.
Perhaps they discovered something, something not yet known by us, that compelled them to provoke the renewal of hostilities. We can speculate as to their reasons from dusk till dawn.
Which is precisely my point, the president interjected. All we can do is speculate. I, for one, am not comfortable launching a strike against their most valuable military assets based on speculation.
The president looked around at the other representatives in the room. We are leaders, leaders of worlds, worlds that have banded together to ensure the safety and freedom of all. We cannot afford to speculate.
Trust me, Mr. President, Admiral Gagliardi countered. When I tell you that we cannot stop an onslaught of 5 battle platforms and their accompanying warships, I am not speculating. I am stating facts. And the facts are, if we do not take those platforms out now before they are alerted, our odds of survival change from quite good to quite poor. The question you must ask yourselves is what is more important to each of you, your morals and ethics, or the safety of those you represent? If it is the latter, perhaps you should consider stepping down to allow those who have the stomach for war fight this war.
Even if this war does not need to be fought? President Scott asked, challenging the admiral.
Do you honestly believe the Zhong planned on honoring the ceasefire forever, Mr. President? It was only a matter of time. To be honest, I'm surprised it has taken them this long.
And what of the Zhong on the Pentaurus cluster? President Scott wondered. If they have jump drives, wouldn't it be prudent to assume the Zhong here have them as well?
Admiral Gagliardi took a moment, considering his position.
Again, it is all speculation, he finally said. We don't even have confirmation that the ships that invaded the Pentaurus cluster are Zhong ships.
We have seen the images, one of the representatives insisted,
of the ships that look similar to those of the Zhong but with obvious differences.
Admiral Gagliardi replied, cutting him off.
Has anyone bothered to ask the Zhong if they are responsible for the attacks in the Pentaurus cluster?
The representative from the Tau Ceti system asked.
We have sent an invitation to Nor Patri via the diplomatic jump comdrome that we maintain between the Zhong homeworld and Earth, President Scott replied.
And?
They have yet to respond, the president admitted.
Which, I assert, speaks volumes, Admiral Gagliardi warned. If they were innocent of either of the attacks on the PC or the trespasses into Sol Alliance space, would they not say as much? Even if they were guilty, wouldn't they deny responsibility, at least for appearance's sake? Certainly, if they do not wish a return of hostilities, they would have replied, if for no other reason than to delay. All this tells me the Zhong are up to something, and time is running out. We must assume the worst-case scenario, which is that the moment those battle platforms receive word, they will make best possible speed for Seoul. We cannot allow that to happen. We must strike now before it is too late.
President Scott sat motionless in his seat, even as he spoke in calm, measured tones.
Your argument is flawed, Admiral, in that it depends entirely on assumptions and not facts. The only facts you offer is that the Pentaurus cluster has been invaded by jump-capable warships similar in design to those of the Zhong, and linear FTL warships definitely of Zhong design have trespassed in Alliance space. Your only cogent argument is that once the Zhong battle platforms are alerted, we will lose our ability to easily neutralize them. You have no real evidence of Zhong involvement, yet you wish us to authorize a strike of unprecedented proportions, all without any serious attempt to defuse the situation through diplomatic means. Such actions are not those of a leader, at least not a leader whom I would wish upon the people I represent. And as the strike that you are recommending is, in essence, a declaration of war against the Zhang Empire, you require a unanimous vote of this council. As long as I hold my office, I shall not authorize such a declaration, not until I am certain that all possible diplomatic solutions have been exhausted. We have 14 days in which to do just that. I intend to use them. Milan Gento looked confused as he listened to Quarry explain his plans to the team of mechanics and systems technicians gathered in the Yokohama Racing Team's suite within the Gunyoki Racing Platform. "I sense something is bothering you, Mr. Gento," Quarry said, noticing the look on the young man's face. "Where are we going to put these jump-field generators you speak of?" Milan asked. "We're replacing our traditional variable-state reactors with these static-state designs used in the Ronnie jump shuttles. They are more compact, are capable of 30% more steady-state power output, and nearly 60% more burst power output than those currently installed." Milan and the other technicians looked at the jump-field generator sitting on carts next to the Gunyoki fighter they were about to work on, then at the Ronnie static-state reactors on the next cart over. "I still do not believe they will fit." "They will if we remove the battery systems that power the race monitoring systems from the bay just forward of the reactors and knock out the wall between the bays," Quarry explained. "But those systems are required by the Racing Commission," Milan insisted, surprised that his supervisor was even considering their removal. "We will no longer be racing, gentlemen, and these ships are no longer racers. They are to become jump fighters." "We all swore oaths to uphold the rules of the Gunyoki Racing Commission," another technician argued. "We could lose our certifications." "None of the ships we alter will ever be entered in sanctioned Gunyoki races again. In fact, this particular ship has already been decertified by the Commission, so you have nothing to worry about, I promise you." Quarry clapped his hands, rubbing them together eagerly. "Now, shall we get started?" He turned to face the open sides of the Gunyoki fighter, stepping forward. "I've wanted to rip this garbage out of our ships for a long time," he muttered, with a satisfied smile on his face. "Man, that was something," Aiden exclaimed as he took his seat in the Aurora's mess hall and set his tray of food down on the table in front of him. "It went like clockwork." "Except an ledge let that guy slip under us," Allie teased. "I could have got him if we hadn't jumped," Ledge insisted. 30 seconds in the hot zone, those are the rules of engagement," Kenji reminded them. "We didn't miss any of our targets," Charnel bragged as she sat down next to Aiden. "Still, it went a lot easier than I expected," Aiden said. "It was 4 Octo fighters and a cargo ship, Aiden," Kenji reminded him, "against 4 gunships. What'd you expect?" "More than we got, that's for sure," Aiden replied. "Everyone talks about how ruthless the Dusan are." "Careful what you wish for, Aiden," Sari warned. "I heard Captain Nash and Captain Rizel talking," Sergeant Agata said in between bites. "Captain Rizel said we just caught them by surprise, that the Dusan didn't expect any trouble. He doesn't think it'll be that way next time." "Still, it felt good to go on the offensive," Aiden insisted. "Again, it was a cargo ship and 4 Octo fighters," Kenji insisted. 4 less Octo fighters," Aiden corrected with a smile. "Am I right?" he added, leaning into Charnel momentarily. "I can't wait for the next mission." "I can," Kenji said. "Gentlemen," Nathan greeted as he entered the meeting chamber in the Capitol building on Naramis. "I apologize for my tardiness," he continued as he took his seat at the conference table. "As you might imagine, running a rebellion requires many demands of one's time." Nathan adjusted his chair, placing his hands on the table in front of him. "So, have you given my proposal any additional thought?" he asked, looking specifically at Minister Seberon. "I believe I have given your proposal its due consideration, Captain," Minister Seberon replied. "However, I am afraid that my position has not changed. I do not believe it is in Rakuen's best interest to align itself with the Karazari, thereby positioning Rakuen as an enemy of the Dusan Empire." "I see," Nathan replied. He turned to Minister Cornell. "And you share Minister Seberon's position?" "While I share Minister Seberon's concerns about the Karazari's ability to defend the Rogan system, I do not share his opinion that the system would be safer remaining neutral. Therefore, Naramis is prepared to support the Karazari to the extent we are able." Minister Seberon glared at Minister Cornell. "We agreed to stand together in this matter." "We agreed it would be better to stand together in this matter," Minister Cornell corrected. But your refusal to recognize the obvious threat the Dusan posed to the Rogan system confirms our suspicions that Raccoon only cares about Raccoon. Therefore, Neramis must take steps to ensure its own safety. Minister Cornell turned to Nathan. Neramis is ready to sign your charter, Captain Scott, in exchange for technologies that you have offered to share, including, but not limited to, the jump missile surface launch batteries you spoke of at our last meeting.
This is outrageous!
Minister Seberon exclaimed, pounding his fists on the table.
Captain, you cannot arm the Neramisians. It would be a violation of the Treaty of Karain, which has forbidden the Neramisians to possess any weapons that could be used to attack Raccoon.
That treaty also required Raccoon to provide for the defense of Neramis against any and all aggressors, foreign or domestic, Mr. Seberon, Nathan reminded him. Should Raccoon fail to do so, Neramis has the right to provide for its own defense. Mr. Cornell is simply exercising his rights under the Treaty of Karain.
Raccoon is still willing to provide for the defenses of the entire Rogan system, including Neramis.
Given your unwillingness to take reasonable steps to do so in the face of new and greater threats, I think any arbiter would side with Neramis on this one, Nathan insisted.
If Neramis becomes armed, Raccoon will be forced to take action to ensure its own safety, including attacks on military assets on Neramis, even those provided by you, Captain Scott.
And as a member of the Kara Azari Alliance, the Kara Azari and the Aurora will come to the defense of Neramis against any and all aggressors, Nathan warned, including Raccoon. Minister Seberon appeared incensed.
Are you threatening Raccoon, Captain Scott?
I'm merely stating facts, Mr. Seberon, Nathan replied calmly. You may take them as you wish.
Do you really believe the Aurora can defeat our Gunyoki?
Minister Seberon challenged, one eyebrow raised. All 500 of them. 480, Nathan corrected. And yes, without even breaking a sweat. You see, Minister, your Gunyoki fighters, while amazing in their own right, are nothing more than targets when not equipped with jump drives.
And what is to stop us from seizing control of the Rani plant on Raccoon and installing the jump drives ourselves?
Minister Seberon asked, his threat poorly veiled. Perhaps I have not made myself clear, Nathan said, leaning forward to emphasize his point. If Neramis chooses to join our alliance, the Kara Azari will see to its safety, including arming Neramis so they may defend themselves against the Dusan and Raccoon. Should Raccoon take any overt action against Neramis, or in any way threaten the safety of Neramis, you will find the barrels of all of the Aurora's weapons pointed your way, and I will be the one who gives the order to open fire. Is that clear enough for you?
Is this how you force worlds to join your so-called alliance, Captain Scott?
Minister Seberon wondered. No. This is how I stop pompous world leaders from using the misfortune of others to their own advantage, Nathan replied. You see, Minister, everything in life needs to be balanced. Nature itself always seeks such balance. Balance of weights, balance of pressures, balance of salinity, balance of energies, and in this case, a balance of power. Balances are good. They promote harmony. They promote cooperation. That's all we seek, harmony. Unfortunately, you seek advantage when you should be seeking balance, harmony, and cooperation. You see, cooperation would get Raccoon everything it wants, including the cooperation and support of both Neramis and the Kara Azari. Now, you may perceive the Kara Azari as just a handful of ships protected by the Aurora and a few gunships, but you are seeing what we are now, not what we will become. That would be short-sighted, and it would be unworthy of a man of your intelligence. Nathan leaned back in his chair again, as if trying to de-escalate things a bit. Now, the Kara Azari will offer Neramis membership in our alliance, complete with all the benefits that entails. We offer the same to Raccoon, but we are prepared and willing to deal with the consequences of Raccoon's refusal of our offer. I would strongly suggest that you return to your world, share what I have said with you with your people, and let them decide. Nathan rose from his seat. If you'll excuse me, gentlemen, I have other matters to attend to. Good day. Nathan turned and left the meeting chambers, fighting hard to restrain the smile that threatened to adorn his face. Chapter 3 Tarek sat in the cafe in Valaton, picking nervously at his dinner. His wife had not been pleased when he told her he was working late, which was uncharacteristic of Tarek. Had she known the real reason he would not be dining with her this night, she would be even more unhappy.
Tarek did not like keeping secrets from his wife, but he had little choice in the matter. Keeping her out of his clandestine activities was for her protection. At least that's what he kept telling himself. Tarek had been surprised when the Karazari had replied to his message. He was even more surprised, and more than a little terrified, when they instructed him to make contact with a man claiming to be Captain Navarro. More frightening still was the warning the Karazari had included. If the man claiming to be Suvan Navarro turned out not to be who he claimed, Tarek was expected to eliminate him. Eliminate? Are they insane? Tarek couldn't kill an Asani beetle, let alone a human. The best he could hope for was to stun the man and bind him, which would do little good. Either way, he and his wife would have to go into hiding. If the man was a spy, any action taken against him would have consequences. Even talking to him was risky. If the man was working for the Dusan, the mere act of approaching him would identify Tarek as a Karazari spy in the eyes of the Dusan. Although the Dusan might not take immediate action, instead waiting to see what bigger fish they could land through Tarek, eventually he and most likely his wife would be arrested. Tarek only hoped her lack of any knowledge of his activities would shield her from punishment. As he watched the man claiming to be Suvan Navarro dine on the far side of the cafe, every fiber of his being told him to pay his bill, head home to his wife, and to never make contact with the Karazari again. Once he disposed of the specialized data storage chip Lieutenant Commander Nash had given him, there would be nothing to connect him with the Karazari, other than an innocent order from Molo Twine from a dealer on Haven, the largest producer of Molo and Molo-based products in the sector. The encrypted message added to that order would appear to anyone as special delivery instructions that somehow got scrambled in the transmission, which was not an uncommon event in interstellar jump comm drone communications. It would be so easy to walk away, save for one thing. We will defeat the Dusan or we will die trying. Captain Scott's words aboard the Mystic Empress still rang in his ears. Men and women, who had no requirement to do so, had pledged their lives to liberate others. Every one of them could leave the area and seek refuge on some other inhabited world, far enough away from the Dusan so as to enable them to live out their lives in peace. Yet they had chosen to stay and defend those who could not, or would not, defend themselves. How could Tarek not do the same and live with himself? Sometimes being an honorable man just plain sucked. Out of the corner of his eye, Tarek spotted Tenzin Dalit paying his bill at his table. Tarek immediately pulled out his personal credit chip and inserted it into the terminal at the center of the table, paying his own bill as well. "Was your food not to your liking?" the waiter asked, pausing when he noticed his customer rising to leave with a full plate of food still on his table. "Huh? Oh, no, it was fine. I'm just not as hungry as I thought," Tarek replied. "I think I have a touch of something," he added, patting his stomach. "Would you like me to package it up for you to take with you?" "No, thank you," Tarek replied, keeping his eyes on Tenzin Dalit, who was already heading for the exit. "The hour is late, and I don't want to miss my train." "As you wish, sir," the waiter replied politely. "Pleasant journey to you." "Thank you," Tarek replied, heading for the exit himself as Tenzin left the cafe. As he made his way across the cafe, Tarek kept his eyes on the windows but did not see Tenzin passing by, which meant he had gone to the right upon exiting the cafe. Tarek followed suit, turning right and heading down the street. At first he thought he had already lost Tenzin, but a moment later he spotted him crossing the boulevard at the next intersection. Tarek quickly darted across the roadway, which at this hour was not busy, quickening his pace in order to move closer to his target. His target. Tarek found the thought amusing, as if he were some kind of assassin. If he weren't so scared, he might have laughed at the thought. Instead, he kept his head down, glancing up, only as often as needed to keep track of the man he was following. But how would he make contact? Wait for the man to get to his residence and then knock on the door? Get on the same train as him? Just walk up to him on the street and strike up a conversation? The truth was, Tarek had no idea what he was doing, which scared him even more. He continued to follow Tenzin to the subway station in the city center. Valaton was one of several transportation hubs around Suskina, used to ferry workers to the shipyards well beyond the orbit of Takara. It was not uncommon for workers to stop for dinner on their way from the spaceport to the subway to Suskina, which was where most of them lived. Tarek got in line with only a few people behind Tenzin. He kept his eye on Tenzin as he inserted his personal credit chip to pay for entry into the subway system. Tenzin had taken the escalator down to the northbound platform, confirming that he was, in fact, heading for Suskina. Tarig was quick to follow, taking the same escalator to the platform below. As he descended, he spotted Tenzin moving through the crowd, positioning himself to board the next train. Tarig followed suit, moving to the same area, but maintaining a few meters between himself and Tenzin.